for October the 19th, South Central on the 17th, 18th, Southeast Alaska, I believe, between the 14th and 18th of November. If you would all please bear in mind that we wish to discuss only the one topic today, and that's discussing on the public inebriate problem. I'd like to ask Mrs. Byrne to open up the presentation here, and then I do have a list of people who are present, and I'll just, unless there's someone who has a time crunch, I'll just take them in the order that they appear on my list. If someone does have that time crunch, please say so, and we'll accommodate you for the next person. Dr. Byrne.
Thank you, Senator Plata and Senator Ray. I want to express appreciation on the part of the municipality for your coming up to Anchorage and for holding the hearings, which I think many of us feel are extremely important if we're going to meet the needs of the public inebriate in Anchorage. I have here a very short presentation that I thought I would just express some of my views at the moment and give reference to some materials which we have, which I think the committee has already been privy to, but perhaps some others who are finally concerned would find them helpful. I would say that the area of involuntary commitment or protective custody, as we are probably going to refer to it, of persons who are incapable of protecting themselves and others due to chronic alcoholism appears to be in need of some legislative action. We could call this protective custody, and it could be, it would seem to me, amended into either the present Uniform Alcoholism Act, or possibly there's a possibility it could be amended into one of the new bills which will be before you next year, or is before you, House Bill number 472, which is one which speaks to involuntary commitment of those with mental health problems. This particular bill, as I read it over, seems to have a less cumbersome commitment proceedings. I'm not recommending that they be one and the same, but that perhaps maybe the proceedings that are spoken to in that bill might be a little less cumbersome than the ones that we have at the present time. There also was House Bill 733 in 1976, which had a better commitment to procedure, but which did not pass, which might be of excellent reference. It appears to us that the present statutes, although they speak to involuntary commitment or protective custody, are so cumbersome and unclear that people are unwilling to test them. And therefore, we're finding it very difficult to hold them, even though they are demonstrating a lack of capacity to manage their own affairs, or rather they're even harmful to themselves and others. And this has been an issue of all of us, I think, here at the table, and we're very concerned that something be clarified so that we are capable of exercising that particular concept. We also feel that there are two major populations in the city which we have to discuss at the same time as we talk about what we're calling the public inebriate. And the one group is what we are calling the so-called public inebriate population. And this is a group which is a fair percentage of the so-called alcohol population. They're very visible, and they're a source of harassment to the people, especially in downtown areas. It's the visibility that's bothering a number of people as much as the fact that these people are human beings and need treatment. And it is creating the pressure on many of us to get them out of sight in any way possible. Right, this is one group. We're finding that some of these people, they're apathetic, they're irresponsible in nature, they have no personal residence and no funds. They frequent bars and utilize the public support monies on alcohol for purpose of warmth and environment and companionship, rather than the fact that they want alcohol per se. So we feel that we're talking about a fair number of these so-called inebriates who really are probably social service cases or of a more of a derelict or an irresponsible nature. Many of them may not even be that. They may be disenfranchised and displaced people from the rural areas. There has been a recommendation made in the past that perhaps we could think in terms of a different type of facility for these individuals. We feel that if such a facility were found, it would probably be very minimal security, work-oriented program, possibly some culturally related activities, and it would not necessarily have to be treatment-oriented. nor would it have to be overly expensive. Right? Such a facility, we feel, would take a fair number of people out of what we're calling our alpha center or our walk-in center, and would allow then those people who come in there who are true alcoholics be given additional time, and where alcohol money would be spent on alcoholism per se rather than on people who just don't have homes. The second group that we have to talk about, of course, is that which is a much larger population, and I'll just mention it in passing, and that is the driving drunk. We're finding that this is a large number of people. Some of the recent statistics we got were that 8,000 criminal offenses during the past year, of those, 2,200 were alcohol related. There were 961 citations in the Anchorage area, and these were DWIs. There were very few of them sentenced, although the drunken public law appears adequate. We don't have the facilities to hold the individuals. Once again, these are people who probably are, many of them like ourselves, they own a car, they can afford a car, they have a home, probably have a job, and they are given sentences which are suspended because there's no place to hold them. They do not need maximum security. The possibility is they need a place where they can be sentenced for 3 days, with the main issue of sentencing being that they have some education forced upon them, driving education. They are good people, they're wage earners, they're tax supporters, they are irresponsible drinkers, driver drinkers. And so here is another area where we need some sort of a facility where people can be placed for some type of treatment and to carry out the letter of the law, which at the present time is a good law. I only mentioned this in passing. The one we're here today to talk about is the involuntary commitment or protective custody. And I think we have to take both those who are the true inebriates and those who are the more of the delinquent or irresponsible type into consideration as we talk about that. I have here the opinions which have been given to us up to this point from our own city attorneys as well as from the attorney general. And in almost every case, it frightens people somewhat after they read the opinions to go ahead and exercise an involuntary commitment proceedings. We also have here Peters versus the state case, which many have based their opinions on. I probably have about 10 copies of these, which some people may be interested in.
That's one in Barrow.
Thank you.
That's one in Bucci River, right?
Senator Ray, questions?
No, I think she's covered it pretty well. I would disagree with some of her points in saying that the majority of the alcoholics are the ones that are visible. I think the majority of the alcoholics are the closet type, guys that you and housewives, people who work, miss time at work, unhappy in their jobs, perhaps just bored with their life, looking for something else to do. The visible ones, I don't think, that's the end result.
Mr. Chairman, may I just answer that?
Please.
As a matter of fact, I think if I said that, I didn't intend that. It is exactly the opposite. This group we're talking about is only probably 5% of the total alcoholism population, and we're putting 90% of our money into them. We're putting it into them because they are visible and they're a harassment to the public.
I misunderstood you right now, because I thought that you said that the average drunk or wino, I guess you'd say, that you see them down the street. I don't know what you're going to do with them, except put them away someplace for his own good, for the good of the rest of the people.
May I just make one other statement? I think I should really have expanded on the fact that the involuntary commitment certainly would address this group that Senator Ray is talking about. We have many closet drinkers, many people at home, and an involuntary type of commitment with a humane substance to it would certainly help that type of individual.
Senator Ray?
Then you're going to have to get around the law, as it's written now. It's not a crime to be a drunk.
Dr. Burnham?
Indeed, that's so. I personally would not like to see it go back to where it is a criminal offense, but I would like to see something where we could hold them against their will if they're incapable of making decisions and are a harm to themselves and to the public, much as we've attempted to do with mental health.
Do you think you get the public support to repeal the act, make drunkenness a crime again?
I don't have a feeling we would get the support to make it a crime again. I think we would get much support in strengthening the commitment laws.
Well, the commitment laws now is put people away if they're minister themselves or somebody else. And same thing about just walking around falling down, sitting around down on Third Avenue or whatever you call it, or down to South Franklin and Juneau. Unless they are harassing somebody, then it becomes disorderly conduct, of course. I think that if you read the Peters case in which Judge Bucci went into some great detail on it and seemed to be strung out on it pretty good, I think it's about 16 pages long. He put 8 pages of it to, in reference to the Uniform Alcoholism Treatment Act, or whatever they call it. So I don't know how I'm not in disagreement with you, but I just don't know what public support would be, you know?
Maybe some other individual can give an idea of what they think public support might be.
Yeah.
Senator?
Yeah, I'd like to hear somebody else.
I have no objections to allowing an informal atmosphere, but in the sake of time, let's limit questions from anyone who wishes the immediate speaker.
Let's hear what Brian's got to say, Mike. Let's hear what the police would do. Let's hear what the police would do in rounding up the drunks and hauling them in.
Mr. Porter?
Well, police throughout the state, I think, were the first people to have to respond to this new act, and as has been said, it's a civil procedure with what appears to be as many or more right protections for the client as a criminal procedure. It's a foreign procedure to us, very hard and cumbersome to work. We're not adapted to civil law, nor do we have, frankly, the time to put into the requirements of an involuntary civil commitment. In terms of alternatives and public acceptability, it's probably not our field, but the state right now, as I understand it, is looking at obtaining funds to take a really in-depth look at their criminal justice procedure from stem to stern, with the idea of not making little finite detail changes, but major changes. And I would think that this particular issue, since it is of such importance within the state, would be amenable to being addressed in that research to see if there is a procedure that could be developed that is between criminal and civil that, just off the top of my head, perhaps could have the expediency of a criminal procedure but have the privacy, as we do with criminal records in other instances, that would make it publicly acceptable. I think probably, I have a problem right off the start, but the act as it's constituted now that this is an illness. I think a person can choose where he elects to be ill, which takes it out of an illness in terms of public intoxication, and that's the problem we're talking about now. If there were some middle ground procedure that would be workable, that we could work and then actually make an effect of this kind of problem on the street, it may be publicly acceptable and it may be efficient enough to operate. There's one other alternative method that I know was somewhat successful in St. Louis a number of years ago, that a person was picked up by a police officer. A summons on a criminal charge was written, but he was taken to a treatment facility. The law allowed a certain amount of time for this person to become rational, and then the treatment people looked at him, examined him, tried to define the problem, and said, "We have determined that you have this kind of a problem. We've had time to look at your past history, and they give you a physical examination and all of that. And we think that you need X program of treatment. We would like you to volunteer for that program of treatment. If you choose not to, there is a summons written by the police in your file here that we will send on to the court, and you will go on for disposition there." You can't treat someone unless you possess them for the period of treatment. And short of an involuntary procedure, which is too cumbersome to really work, we're not treating anyone.
You want to cure alcoholism, I guess you'd have to get a psychiatrist for the world. That would be the,
for sure,
the ultimate. Find out what the problem is, and cure the problem, cure the effect.
Would Dr. Burney wish to respond?
I hadn't given a thought to the one I thought was a very cogent statement that Brian made, and that was something with the expediency of a criminal procedure, but keeping it on the privacy level of a mental illness. That it is sort of a compromise type of thing that should probably be looked into. I think one of the reasons that there was a distaste for having it a criminal procedure is they felt that possibly anything, even on the records, although kept private, might hinder future working relationships and put people on welfare rolls where otherwise they could be working individuals.
One of the things
there might be
this,
ways to handle that.
One of the things that the state study is going to address is a form of hearing outside of the formal court setting, hearing officers and administrative proceedings as opposed to full court proceedings. The civil remedies that are in the Act now require jury trials and formal court settings, and so the privacy is gone either way.
You know, we do have, are fortunate to have two gentlemen here, courtesy of Governor Hammond's administration. We do have Commissioner Williamson, Department of Health and Social Services, and Mr. Richard Peters, the Attorney General's office. Mr. Peters, I wonder if you could comment on what Mr. Porter has said in the review process.
Well, what he was aiming at would seem to be an ideal solution if we're capable of being worked out. It's what is most desirable, I think. I'm sure there's no disagreement with that, whether a system could be devised that would incorporate both those features. Where the bill, for example, which is before you now, was submitted by the governor last year, that was mainly to incorporate, to merge these two offices, and also to clean up the what is a facility, a private facility, a public facility, and no changes were made as to commitment procedures, but there's no reason why they shouldn't be made if a desirable substitute can be found. But we really haven't gone into that phase. This is the first time I've heard such a suggestion as this, but it certainly has merit. It would give us a direction in which to investigate anyway.
We had a hard time, I don't know, I think Kellen was even in the house, and we had a hard time getting the drunks off of the highways, remember? Where you been in? This simple bill of keeping a drunk off the highway, you know, we can't infringe on personal liberties. He wants to walk up and down the highway drunk, he can't. If he gets hit by a car, then it's his fault. He wasn't paying attention to it. So that's what I was talking about, public acceptance. I don't know if the swing has come the other way, whether the pendulum has swung backward, but the liberality that we've experienced over the last period of maybe 10 years, I don't know. Now we're talking about, and the Attorney General's office is very interested in legalizing the use of cocaine. Here we're talking about putting drugs in here. I don't know.
Anyone else wish to comment?
Senator Coletta.
Please.
I'm Paul Faulkner. I'm the interim representative for the state of Alaska and hospitals and institutions. And I'm employed at API. We currently have at API today what is commonly referred to as the Moody blank check. For those of you who are not familiar with this, any peace officer or correctional officer can predetermine a mental state of a patient and subsequently transfer them to API, to the security unit. This then can give ample opportunity for screening and determination as to the mental capacity of the individual. Perhaps something similar to this could be so ordained for the city of Anchorage or the state of Alaska, in which a determination could be made as to the alcoholic's capability of understanding right from wrong and whether he could function in the community. And if he could not, then he could in fact be committed under this type of order to X agency for a period of time, and the determination then be made as to continuing treatment. It is working remarkably well with mental patients and could be then in turn, I'm not suggesting that API take alcoholics, but it could in turn be, this format could be utilized for the alcoholic.
You're talking of municipal living and not necessarily bush living, because the more agent is.
Yes, I am.
Entirely different.
It could perhaps be extended so that any magistrate or judge could give this carte blanche to the determining officer, in this particular case, probably the arresting officer, or his immediate superior.
Thank you. Any additional comment? If not, then we have a request. One gentleman must leave. We'll hear him next. Marcelo Quinto, president of the Alaska Native Commission on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse.
Yes, I'm Marcelo Quinto. I am president of the Alaska Native Commission on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. It's a board, a nonprofit organization that was set up about 4 years ago, which would provide some input and information and programs from the rural areas. We have been operating on a statewide basis for the last 4 years. We have gone on record as a board in supporting the governor's package. Now, particularly in a couple of different areas. One, really relative to sale and distribution of alcohol, which really has concerned a lot of the smaller rural areas, for different reasons, I guess. And the other area certainly was the excise tax, pretty much because of the rural communities being so far out, it's been so costly to try to develop programs in that area. We pretty much want to be here, Senator, just to testify the fact that we do support it. We also understand and appreciate the activities you're going through right now to certainly try to work and deal with the problems. I do have some written testimony. I will follow up with this in Juneau, but I think probably key area, which is to indicate that we are a concerned group. We do have programs that are active throughout the state of Alaska, and certainly we have been gone through as a growing unit, have also identified with the needs for dollars to operate these programs, and would certainly appreciate and work with any assistance that your committee would provide.
Thank you. Mr. Quinto, before you leave, could we get you to reflect on the one topic that we wish discussion on today, and that's involuntary commitment or protective custody, whatever.
Well, we have discussed it as a board on several occasions. Recognizing that the areas that I represent are relatively very small, and you certainly can't provide the facilities, in every small little community that we're speaking of. We do recognize that in many cases, especially in rural Alaska, the need for, some involuntary restriction of a person, especially not is uncontrollable, but how do you provide that activity in such a small rural area? You don't have, a state trooper in every community, yet you have accessibility of alcohol to every small community, throughout the state. And it's become a very serious problem in many, many cases that, we've been aware of as trying to restrain, an alcoholic or an alcoholic abuser, from physical force. It's been really probably the key area as to why we've needed some type of restriction. Right now you don't have it.
Senator
Marcelo, you said that you supported the governor's package
we support it in pretty much in concept there, Bill.
Do I also support his belief that unless you increase the tax on alcohol, that no new facilities will be built?
Not necessarily.
Would you want the facilities irrespective if it's, it's a problem that we recognize as, I think the quotes in most places, Alaska's major problem, and I would think that irrespective of where the money come from, if it comes from oil or fish or anyplace else, I would think we need the facilities first and then we'll worry about the money next.
Well, that's really kind of key to us, yes. We recognize that, in any tax issue that we're not that naive that you really need the public support, as you say before, in order to get it. We recognize the need and hope that you'll be recognize the ability to take care of that.
Well, the legislature and its stupidity, I guess you would say, or whatever you would care to classify what we do down in the legislature, had several projects dealing with alcoholism that were redlined because of taxes weren't increased comparable to what the government felt.
Well, Bill, I guess the thing is we've
I'd just like to ask a question of Marcelo, since within the municipality we are finding that some of our major problems are dealing with the native population, that I think they have probably been displaced. They've come into town, they have no way of getting back home again, and there is a question as to whether they truly have a true alcoholism problem or whether they have no place to go, and so they're using their money on alcohol in order to have companionship. But let's assume that some of them are walking into the walk-in center on the average of, say, 8 to 10 to 12, maybe 20 times a month. They're revolving in and out. And apparently we're not taking care of them. We're not doing what should be done for them. Right. Do you think that if there was a long-term care facility that was skill-oriented, that was minimal security, and if there was some sort of a commitment procedure where after a person rotated in and out of such a facility 10 times and someone said they cannot take care of themselves and committed them for 30 or 60 days to a facility, would you feel if that would be against any of our civil rights activities? Or I'm even thinking about a type of facility such as like the Palmer Adult Camp, which has such a highly skill-oriented program out there. It's outside of the city, it's away from the city, and I'm only referring now to natives because I'm talking to you, but we have many non-natives who fall in the same category. Yeah. What would you think of something of that nature?
Well, I guess my first reaction to that, Dr. Burns, is that I was trying to remember, I believe that when they first set up the honor farm out at the outside, wasn't that initially a 30-day or 60-day, once you went into that facility, you had to be there 30 to 60 days, right?
That was the problem, that it wasn't.
No, I know when they first started that program, though, I thought that was 30 to 60 days, you had to be there. I thought that was under, wasn't that under course? Maybe I'm wrong. I really don't know. I would say that, in order for any, you're aware of yourself, until you get them into there for a period of time where you can work with a person, you're going to probably get better results, Until ask me the question whether or not the civil rights of, any native or any non-native, to be restricted for 30 to 60 days, if they're, I would imagine, if they're a menace to, themselves and to, certainly to the community, I would say that, it's probably necessary. You get any of anybody else asking you the same blessed question, they tell you, hell no, I don't want to be restricted for any reason. You tell me there's no drunken public law, why should I be confined? I don't know. I know that you probably get the better results, but in terms of relative, I don't know who, whether the support is there. Zeno was asking go back, to step back and maybe pick up some of the old laws that are available. But certainly we recognize it as a problem in rural areas, and in a number of areas that we've had to try to, constrain people, but
I wonder if there is a difference in what John's saying, though, and I'm sure that he...
I misread the question, I don't know.
The police officers here understand and get somebody put in for 5 years for use of heroin or drugs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And how many times they're removed from society, they have counseling and all the rest of them, how many times are those people, do they come by heroin when they're in the joint? Times. In other words, you're not curing anything. You got to get to the basic problem to make with what makes the guy do it to start with. What makes it before he gets to the point where it becomes a physiological change, where his system changes. I'm not a doctor, but if you can get him before that time and cure his problem, then you got it made. But once his system requires it, the metabolism breaks down or whatever you call it, once that happens, then you're dealing with an entirely different problem. Then you're dealing with an illness. Previous to that time, you have a problem with the head, perhaps.
Well, you got time involvement there too, you know, and that's what you're saying too, is that unless they have the time to work with the field with that person, you know, they really can't get to the bottom of the issue, you know, what is the problem? You know, I guess another area that, you know, Dr. Burns asked, you know, that you have so many of the native people that do come into the Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau area that, you know, that come in for a long, you know, for the after the season work or whatever it is, and they mill around and they do end up at the barns, I guess, is what, you know, you're alluding to, and that they're, you know, the drinking patterns there, they're they're the visible joint that you see. Can you restrict them? And not, what was the thing? They go against their civil, you know, civil rights. Huh? Under today's laws, no, you can't. Because, you know, you would go against it. Those are the things you people are wiser than I will have to deal with.
And yet we have all these, we have all these programs, outreach programs, and we have people running around bringing the native peoples in from their usual existence, kind of a nomadic hunting and fishing and whatever they are, but we're going to save them, and so we bring them into the communities, into the population centers, because you're going to get a check once a month for whatever federal or state program is, and after they drink that up, then they sit around the rest of the time waiting to get the next check, and then the next time you got a problem, pretty soon you got a bunch of drunks milling around, and you're going to put them in jail because, why? Because they can't take care of themselves? They've been taking care of themselves for a good many years before we ever got here.
But any additional comment? Yes.
Okay, my name is Joy Burrell. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Native Commission and work for Marcelo and the rest of the board. In regards to involuntary commitment and the laws which are in the governor's package, which tend to regulate the sale and distribution. You know, the two are related in that if you don't have any laws in regards to the sale and distribution of the beverage alcohol, particularly in the rural areas, and no involuntary commitment, or anybody who is prepared to enforce involuntary commitment, then it doesn't do any good. You know, if you have one without the other, you know, you must have an organization or a body of people who are going to, and not only in be able to enforce the sale and distribution, but also take care of the person who for involuntary commitment, who does present a danger primarily to themselves and to other members of the community. And as you know, that happens quite a bit in the rural areas when in accidents relating to discharge of firearms, drownings, and so forth, most of those are alcohol related. I'd like to provide a comment in regards to what Dr. Bird said about involuntary commitment or a facility to place those people in the area such as Anchorage and Fairbanks. While that is very good and is something which a good facility like that is needed, however, it, again, that does no good if we're talking particularly in regards to the native population, because they do eventually go back to their community again, and without some kind of continuing support from their own communities, you can expect, of course, to see them back in that community time and time again. So what you need is you need a number of things, and that is primarily beginning with a source of referral from the community, but also once they return to their community, continuing support for those people. And of course, that's what we don't have right now.
Good thing. Well, we have Alaska. We get down to basics. Alaska is a legally allows the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages. And that doesn't mean for a white man in the municipalities, and not the native in the bush, or a white man that goes to the bush, he's allowed to drink. I think we're going to have to sit down and address ourselves to basics. Getting a drying out center is wonderful, and staffing it with a half a dozen psychiatrists that will tell these poor people that are addicted to the use of alcohol what the problems are, or listen to what the problems are. But when you're talking about commitment for 30 days, unless you eliminate his original problem, he'll be right back with it. It's the same as a heroin user or anything else.
Sir? I'm Arthur Groom. I'm with the Anchorage Council on Alcoholism. I have just personal views to express, not those of the council. Our director asked me yesterday my opinions, and I told her, and she asked that I voice them here. To begin with, at the start of the meeting, Senator, you reminded us that this was to talk about the nuisance of the public inebriate and the danger of the drunk driver. There is no purpose in this meeting talking of a long-term treatment for alcoholism, which is an incurable disease. It has nothing to do with taxes or where liquor is sold. As for the public inebriate, the drunk driver, my own opinions are very, very simple. Certainly not costly at all. A matter of protective custody, Dr. Byrne mentioned the possible holding for 3 days. I'm in complete agreement with that for this reason. I'm a comfortable alcoholic myself. I do not drink. I have not for a long time. I've been arrested many, many times in my drinking career. And I learned this very, very simply, that the holding of the drunk, which is done in many communities for 6 hours, 8 hours, at which time the blood level would show he is not legally drunk, and releasing him, does not do a bit of good, because the physical craving for a drink is still there. The idea of holding for 3 days, which I think is so good, there wouldn't be any legal commitment, no judges, attorneys, bondsmen, or anything like that involved. Just holding in protective custody for 3 days. Because after 72 hours, the drunk has a freedom of choice as to whether he wants to drink or not. I think in less than 72 hours, there isn't any choice there. He must. I know I went through this. I would get out of jail and walk around the corner to the nearest bar and start it again. And that would get the public inebriate out of public view. It would get the dangerous drunk driver off the street. It is absurd to arrest somebody for drunk driving and to permit him to be bailed out right away and to fine him a pittance of $300. It accomplishes nothing, and all of us know that. But to hold the person for 72 hours, he does then have a freedom of choice as to whether he wants to go back to drinking. Less than that, he must. Thank you, that's all I have to say.
Dr. Williamson?
I just wanted to ask Dr. Berman a question. Helen, you mentioned what you felt was a need for a facility. It wouldn't have to be a treatment-oriented thing, more of a program sort of thing. I'm just curious about this idea. I've talked a little bit with others about it. What elements would you have in such a program that you feel might stop sort of the revolving door syndrome?
Recently we had what we called a provider's workshop here. A large number of people in the Anchorage area that are providing services for people who have alcoholism-related problems were here. One of the outstanding issues that arose, and one of the major considerations, was that we have a number of people who probably drink because they want the companionship, or they want warmth, or they have no place else to go. And there's a good possibility that maybe a third of them might fall in this category. If indeed we could get a long-term, skill-oriented facility, some of these people are going to have to stay there. But they don't belong in a nursing home, they don't belong in a pioneer home. They need just a protective environment where they can do their thing. Some of them are receiving SSI checks, receiving longevity bonuses, aid to the disabled, almost enough to support themselves. And with some additional work and skills that they have, they probably can support themselves to the total amount of $400 or $500 a month, which they could manage and probably keep the facility running. The old Honor Farm we used to have here in Anchorage was similar to that. At that time, it was a criminal offense to be drunk, and many people would go out and break a window about this time of the year to get committed, so they'd be warm for the winter. We're probably going to have a number, especially in the Fairbanks area, that are going to be picked up for breaking and entry because they're going to be freezing and they'll break a window and crawl into somebody's warm room. And they'll be picked up, thrown into jail for the winter. In essence, maybe if we had a protective type facility and with the recognition that they're going to probably have to spend a big share of their time there, but can possibly support themselves with their present incomes, whatever it might be, public and some private, we might be having a preventive type program that would keep them from becoming criminally involved and having to go into a traditional type jail cell, which is so expensive.
And you think that people such as what we're referring to here as the public inebriate would voluntarily, or
I think many would, many would voluntarily quit. I think some of them would skip out occasionally and go out on a binge. But I think they'd come back. It'd be better to have them out one weekend on a binge and back in there the rest of the time than it would to have them out here on 4th Avenue night after night curled up around a hot pot.
Senator Glenn, again, like Arthur, I am a recovering alcoholic, and I have a long career of sobriety. I've also been a professional in the field of alcoholism before.
Thank you.
Senator Gletta, again, like Arthur, I am a recovering alcoholic, and I have a long career of sobriety. I've also been a professional in the field of alcoholism for approximately 15 years.
On record as an individual taxpayer and voter in the state of Alaska, and state there is no viable treatment center in the state of Alaska today, period. As a recovering alcoholic, a short-term treatment center merely alleviates the condition for that period of time. Long-term treatment in my experience, my past, my background has been the only concept. The endorsement of the old Palmer facility and or the El Kemper youth camp, which is still owned by the state, I understand, might be the answer that we're seeking. We're looking to actually remove the public inebriate off the street. And in removing that public inebriate off the street for a period of 30 days or less, we're going to have the revolving door that Kellen was referring to. And a program, we will say 6 months, we will have probably a greater recovery rate. Doing this by, of course, permitted therapy and a lot of the other things.
Time is rapidly eroding out here with discussion and discussion, but nonetheless, let's try to confine the balance of the morning. And if we have additional time, we'll be able to cross comment. But Dr. Ray Dexter, tell us now.
I agree with what Arthur's been saying. We have this experience with our walk-in center that people come in, spend the night, and go back on the street and drink again. What they're coming in for really is shelter, a place to get away from the cold, and going back. to deal with an alcoholic, I think we all recognize that, that motivation has a great deal to do with it. And that presupposes some kind of rational choices on that part. When you have a person that is just dried out overnight, just enough to be able to walk back on the street again, he isn't still at that point capable of making any kind of rational choices. Unless we have some way of holding somebody so that you can do some motivational counseling with him and doing something, trying to get him into a long-term treatment. Again, I agree with the other gentleman that this long-term treatment for most of these people is really the only viable alternative. But until they're capable of making some rational choices and actually committing to some kind of treatment, we don't have a handle on them. They walk right out again on us. And we have this revolving door syndrome that we're all familiar with. I would very much support some kind of handle where people can be committed, at least to the place where they are capable of making some choices themselves. How long that would be, I think, is a question. Certainly 3 days is going to get rid of the immediate effects of their intoxication. Whether 3 days is enough really to do any real motivational counseling and get at what some of the sources that are intrinsic sources of their problem is another question. But I think if you can't hold somebody for at least those 3 days so that they are capable of some kind of rationality, they're just going to go back on the street again and continue their thinking until they get to the place where they're going to be so mentally incapacitated with chronic brain damage that they will be capable of being committed then to some other kind of institution. Hopefully, we'd like to get them before that happens so that we can intervene in the process of alcoholism so that they don't get there. I see, unless we have a handle so that we can keep somebody who is obviously incapacitated, who is just going to go out and continue his process, we really have no way of dealing with this kind of person.
What's taking you out?
Pardon?
What's taking you out?
I have never...
I'm very serious.
Yeah.
What's taking you out?
I am not an alcoholic.
I think you said you were.
No.
You were.
We were.
What's taking you out?
With due respect to all of the assembly here and requesting that you recognize my anonymity, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and have been 64% recovered.
My answer is the same, and anonymity is important to us, not to be public.
Do we have reporters present? Would you please honor two requests?
Thank you. Now we do have a handle on people who have run afoul of the law because of alcoholism, and we are working with the courts now in terms of commitment to our program with a signed bench warrant if they defect. So in a sense, we give them an alternative that is really very unpleasant. They either stay with treatment or they go to jail. That can hold people. But you can't hold somebody if they haven't committed a crime, as the law currently is. And it's this crowd, I think, that we're concerned about right now. Not the people who have committed a misdemeanor or a felony, that you have a chargeable offense. Those kind of people, we do have a handle on, and we can keep them in treatment, or they go to jail. It's the people who really have no other crime except being totally incapacitated through the use of alcohol that we really have no way of keeping and treating and at least bringing into the place where they can elect themselves to do something about it. And until we have that kind of handle, I see no hope for the chronic kind of drunks that we get in our walk-in center that come in and sleep off the night and then go back out in the street and drink, because they're committed to thinking.
Now, both you gentlemen have in-depth and ongoing counseling, right? mean, I don't know how you...
Second, Senator Ray. Counseling per se from Alcoholics Anonymous is... Yes, it is in depth. It is ongoing. We recognize our own recovery is contingent upon meeting that may be for the rest of my life. And I like it. It isn't.
You want it?
Yes.
You want it to do it. But first,
there's motivation, Senator Ray. There has to be. When you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, then you do something for it.
So that's...
Well, however, if I can continue, I was too sick to recognize motivation. And I was motivated by another person who told me there is another way. I was counseled in everything.
Could you do that in 3 days?
Good God, no. All I could do in 3 days is sober, was sober enough to hear.
Senator, I'm Representative of the thing.
I want to thank both of you for sharing what you've done here. I'd like to know a little bit more terms of AA and what they do in the community. I'd also like to know if this is associated in the method by which the Lutheran Hospital in Chicago does some of their work, how they go about doing that, you know, and stop that development. So that's a little bit of
I'm vaguely familiar with the Lutheran Hospital work. I can say that all viable treatment programs that I have been involved with in the past 20 years have utilized Alcoholics Anonymous to a great extent as an adjunct to their own treatment and their own therapy to move the client or the patient from treatment to a lifetime program is simply to motivate. Again, Dr. Milam in with his Alpinas program in Seattle, which is endorsed incidentally by the CCC. Hazelden in Minneapolis, many other treatment programs, including the one I came from in Las Vegas, utilize Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous recovery rate currently is 64% nationwide. We also have among our membership somewhere over 1.5 million to 2 million. And quite frankly, gentlemen, if it works, don't think.
Paul, if I might, following up on Senator Ray's question, would involuntary commitment be one step closer towards the motivational attitude?
I agree, yes.
Involuntary.
I was in jail, Senator. Hit the mule between the eye, up
getting the tent. Just getting the tent. Captain Boy, I've been doing that with Bert Hall for years.
You're working.
But you aren't paying attention. Captain Boy. I'd like to speak primarily to the process of involuntary communication. I think where you can establish, and I think the criteria would need to be established, to exercise any involuntary commitment. And it could be established on the basis of so many times a detox or so many rest or whatever. I think in order to get that involuntary commitment and get the proverbial 2x4 between the mule's eyes or whatever, I think that's really essential. And how long a person could be committed, the way the law stands right now, it is difficult, even for protective custody. They have to be, as I understand the law, pretty much comatose before they could be protectively taken into protective custody. And it makes it really difficult to do that sort of thing. I think where you could establish some record of 3 or 4 times in detox in 6 months, or maybe one time a month in detox in 6 months, should be a sufficient criteria to put a person in committing for a period of time, and what it takes to get him to begin to look at himself, whether it be 3 days or a week or a month or what. I think perhaps maybe short time to commitment might be more favorable to long-term commitment. I think where you could establish a long period
of abuse of alcohol, I think it would be a lot easier at that point than to establish some sort of further commitment to a treatment facility of some kind. I hardly appreciate these men here giving their testimony this morning. And we believe strongly in AA approach. We don't believe that's the only approach, but we do believe it, and we incorporate that in our treatment service on a voluntary basis and on an involuntary basis for some of our clients. And so I think it's just a melee of approaches to dealing with an alcoholic in the terms of therapeutic process.
You mentioned the present law as being perhaps doesn't allow the full scope. In other words, you're afraid of it. And I've read some of the statements and some of the opinions put out by the city of Anchorage, and I think they were written primarily to make sure that everybody understood that the city of Anchorage would not be liable for any personal damage in picking up a drink. I think that was the motivation behind it. I think the law is written, I'm not an attorney, but I've been in the legislature long enough to be able to recognize some of the methods that people use when determining what the law says. I think that law is pretty broad, and of course I've talked to my senior from Juneau there, from the Attorney General Roberts, but it's written broad enough that you could take a person into custody. And I think even in Lucy's opinion in the Supreme Court, that he admitted it in there, that you take them in for their own protective custody if they were in danger of harming themselves or others. Now, when you say that, that's pretty broad.
Well, if you take them in custody, as I understand the law, you have to have a doctor right there that says, yeah, they have to be in protective custody.
That's not true. That is what the law says.
Or within a very short period of time, the doctor has to make a decision. Is that what you understand?
Yes, if I understand. They can be held for 48 hours, but during that 24-hour period, they do it for medical surveillance.
Right.
After 48, then they have to be a district or superior court.
Right. But if there isn't a facility as planned by the state, and I don't know how many of there are recognized, and there's been a village, and they're afraid to take them home and leave them in the house because they freeze to death. And they take them into protective custody and put them in jail for a period of 10, 12, 15 hours. There's no doctor's requirement or anything else. You can make a search of the person, everything else connected with it. And it's not a violation of constitutional rights or anything else.
But the problem, I think, with that in Anchorage and probably in the urban areas is that I think the law precludes the use of a correctional facility if there is a
other one
recognized. Unless the recognized facilities are not equipped or of the persuasion to treat people who don't wish to be consequently, the state jail interprets that to say if there is a facility, we can't take them under those conditions, so they're still right now.
Commissioner, do you wish to comment?
No.
All right. Norine Pedrick?
Senator Mary Walters, who is representing the planning department, probably has nothing to say to you instead of knowing.
There are no comments.
What about the alcohol? What about the person who gets inebriated one time in 10 years? He's not an alcoholic. There's no reason to be committed to anything other than to his bed and blanket and you're thrown in jail for 3 days.
I can tell you what we used to do with that type of thing. We had a system whereby a guy could do that twice a year and get a free ride.
Take
a
home. Home.
If he didn't have a home, he would be held for 4 hours to kick loose with no criminal record.
And then what would the civil rights organization or people that are connected to civil rights come around and say, hey, let this guy, we saw
car, and we have a picture of this man, and you're carrying him into your police car, but you didn't put him in jail, you took him home while you took the other guy to jail.
Well, it was funny. It was that type of organization that initiated and supported this, but that was, of course, what we were putting into the
The basis for these questions is in the possible realm of corrective legislation, and I'm not being argumentative, I hope for that. Point that everybody, I'm just being the devil's advocate. We're going to get down there and have to deal with legislators. Well, you're the closest one. You never say anything about your colleagues in the Senate. You're in the
Please. I agree. I think we have to differentiate between a chronic alcoholic and an occasional imbiber who takes too much. And there are criteria for alcoholism, and I think we could incorporate that into the law. There's no problem there. I think there's pretty well documented established criteria for what is a chronic alcoholic. I don't think there would be any legal problem with it. And an occasional drinker who over-imbibes is really not one of our problems. I think
under the existing law, sir, that's what I'm...
Under the existing law...
Don't you agree, Helen, under the existing law, you need some kind of corrective so you can differentiate between the guy that got drunk on the 50th wedding anniversary because he was on the home.
I agree with the doctor. There are two or three methods of testing. Our Rutgers test, the Jelling test, these can make it to those predetermination two different.
Father Farrell.
I'm sorry he's not here, but representing
him.
The only thing is that, you know, the problem is that the church was taking all, and it really has been a problem. They've been all through the house there, you know, really coming into the church and outside, and it's really dangerous for them. So I believe that the father told us this morning that they're going with the police, and they will cooperate with the police because the situation is just beyond control right now. And one thing I just want to add to that, I agree with Dr. Byrne, and talked about this long, because we have these individuals that are long, long term. I mean, they'll never get better if they're the chronic alcoholics. And what they could do is have a rehabilitation where they would really get a skill and do something that would be constructive. They would get some kind of dignity and self-esteem that they would be contributing to something. Right now, they're just drinking. And this would be a chance where a lot of natives are carvers, or people have skills. I mean, there's something else besides being a drunk. And this would put them together, and they could have some kind of treatment or, you know, counseling. And maybe the group would help one another. So that was one that I really support that.
Good. Thank you. Any comments? With that, I think we'll call for a 5-minute recess, let everybody stretch air the room out a little bit. Coffee back here. Ma'am, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
I'm Jane Gray. I work for the Salvation Army Alcoholism Services, and I'm very thrilled to stay with. And I realized that we're on the public inebriate, but I wanted to bring up something Helen brought up, and it's very important to me and as a drunk driver in this state. She said in here that there's a much larger population of drunk drivers than the public inebriates in that self, and my caseload tells me that self. There's a lot of them. Right now we have a training officer in the court, we have classes here. We're working towards controlling this sort of thing and being accountable to the court. But as always, with kind of a program like this, public safety does for a while is supposed to go into the courts or whatever later. And public safety has given us, I think, a good beginning. And if we only take their opinion and their word for it and go ahead, I think in answer you probably got a pretty good start. I don't know that much about the other risks. I believe that when we catch a drunk driver, we probably catch a very early stage alcoholic, if he's alcoholic at all. And so we have to begin the early intervention that Senator Ray talked about, and that there's so much easier to treat than somebody from Fourth Avenue. I like to see a lot more of a fight down there in the state, a lot of fighter injury. And I believe that it's really important for the legislature to, you know, address it. That's about all I had to say. I just want to bring it up and say it's urgent.
Thank you, Senator Ray.
Next individual we're here from is L.E.F. Brown. Can you hear?
Yeah. I think probably the only one of the two things that I can address is that I wasn't really we get all aspects of the alcoholic problems. Both with just the Fourth Avenue type, which is one of the easier ones for me to address because we see so much of that. We also see many in the highway scene, we see them in the home, the criminal aspect. But I think probably the area that we're most involved in on a continual basis is the chronic alcoholism. On Fourth Avenue. At times before the community patrol system was set up, we had to transport a lot of these people to hospitals, which many times we get them to a hospital and they would get us back downtown. It got to be kind of a real hassle for us and for that our people. And you get the attitude that, hey, you know, why take the guy to the hospital and then get it back downtown? Well, they kind of held that thing by them because they have to go on every call they are called to make. And they do go on a call, and as I said before, the control human being, they help us greatly in that we, if the person was not seriously injured, we could call on these people to relieve us of that stress. But there are times when the simple patrol or police patrol system can't respond or aren't able to respond. We have to transport these people to a hospital, which is the only place to do transport in an emergency situation. Now, a lot of times, it's documented, we have had this type of an individual in our unit going to a hospital, and all of our other units have been tied up and have an emergency call come in for somebody with two heart attacks or someone that's been shot or something of a life or death situation has happened. And we can't respond to it because we have this individual in our unit. And this again, is bad on our people because they're out there for the emergency situation, the person is 36, they're at the United States. And we have to deal with the alcoholism that we do on Fourth Avenue with this type of situation. I believe this, for getting public sentiment, will have a great deal of effect if we would have some often important type person have an attack, a heart attack, or whatever, life or death situation. We cannot get to them because we have this type of individual in our video already going to a hospital. Actually, the department is too bad because they have an emergency response. But I think that possibly if there were a situation like this arise, and there is an investigation, which very easily could be, they would find the reason for not being able to respond and having a doctor work in our unit may raise some public sentiment.
Thank you, Senator Ray. Vice President, there were any volunteers from the
Senate.
Ed, since the Salvation Army's emergency service control has come into existence, I presume it's relieved you considerably. But I think my question is, probably you still would be picking up those people who dangerous to be paramedic patients. You find a number of the same person that you can help time after time after time with transport to hospital.
That's true, and I think that possibly each one of our 30 personnel on the street could probably stand on the corner of course and see if they got each and every one of them to be home on a daily basis. They could probably tell you each and every one of them that have feeders back down to come from the hospital. Our reports are public files. They can be checked. And any particular given day, take a 7-day period, and you can take any day and probably find at least a half a dozen people that be home on a daily basis. For no other apparent reason other than that. Possibly a bar owner wants to get them out of the bar. They are falling down. We get many calls, emergency head calls, for a man down. Well, we don't know what a man down is. We don't know who it is. And we just assume that the person is really ill. So we may not have a unit that's close by. For instance, if it's a 4-5 call, we have a unit that's 52. Well, they may be in hospital. And a unit from in our area, we have to go on a call. Well, that means they're going red lights and sirens, and then it's a call downtown, emergency, so a man down. Get down there and find that a man is just sitting there asleep. So there's lots of dangers and hazards in this particular type of content. And 99% of the time, they don't call for the center. It's others that call for them. It's a bad situation, and those are the people that I would like to see some direction towards getting them confined to a facility.
I mean, one of the comments, that in addition to ED services, which has been ongoing for a long period of time, the emergency service calls in Salvage Island. I think the last time since we've been there, that boy's gone, something like that, he's made 100 calls in a day sometimes. Now that's in addition to what Ed is saying.
That's right.
There is a question as to whether this is only 300 people we're talking about, some people that think it's 2,000. I think it's probably somewhere under 500. So you can imagine how many of these people are being picked up time and time again. If we do only have 400 or 500 in this particular population, and what it costs in the country.
We actually know most of these fellows on a first-name basis. They're that familiar to us. We just pick them up and bring them in, and they go out again, and we pick them up. And so we they know us, and we know them.
If I could address a question to Ed. Ed, the Alaska State Troopers recently has come forth with a volunteer services in Eagle River. If a proposal were made, I wonder if we could not develop volunteer patrols to supplement your EMS patrol.
Well, in the 9 years that I've been in the service, since it's called the Eagle River, to my knowledge, we've never been that far.
No, I'm referring to ASP, new volunteer services they got out there tonight, right? Could we not, in fact, develop a volunteer patrol to at least supplement your patrol, your EMS, on a volunteer basis? Anybody held for 3 days wouldn't be the truck downtown.
I don't think we're worried about the liability.
That'd be the problem, the liability.
Malpractice.
And the problem is, unless you have some way of holding these people, we have the same problem that they do. They beat us downtown again. And we can bring them to our walk-in center, but they don't have to stay. They can walk right out again and do what they were doing before.
Because the majority of the hospitals don't want to keep them there.
Won't. They don't want them.
But they'll build a safe, though.
Doug Weifer. Yvonne Alfred. Tom Quinton. Peggy Rostrom.
Rostrom. I have nothing to say. I'm just here on behalf of the municipality. I'm in charge of drafting legislation so that when it comes to the point that we have legislative this person that was drafted and make my recommendations on it. And I'll take you down and hit on next step.
Barbara Hoffman.
Barbara Hoffman is not here.
Bill Farber.
Bill is with the state troopers, is it not? I don't see anyone else here.
Dennis Kelso.
I spend with me in the comments now.
Thank you. Leonard Newton.
Yeah. I don't know what all you've been over this morning, but I assume it has to do with the carbon committee from the DWI and so forth.
Right, those two issues,
the big thing that I see with the drunks that's on Fourth Avenue or the alcoholics is that we do need a way to hold them. We do need some legislation that where we can court commit these people that can at least pick them up and get them dried out enough so they can think off of that avenue. You know, we talk about emergency patrols and stuff. If we had a place to commit these people, that I have heard already just since I've been here, it's the same people over and over and over. And if we look at the expense of what it's costing us as taxpayers, then we need a way to hold them. And if we're going to have to take care of them, let's do it a little bit cheaper way. I know there's a lot of people against courts committing people, involuntary commitment, but I was one of those people that were court committed approximately 18 years ago. And I wouldn't be standing here sober today had they not. Court committed me, paid me a ward of the state of Oregon. And as a result, I'm sober today. And I hope a worthwhile citizen. And again, we talk about the DWI. I just went to court with one yesterday. I will be going back to court with another that I have right now in the studio club. And it's one of them's 50 WI, the other one's 60 WI. When the court had these people in the beginning, you know, you can send them out here to our class once a week. That just isn't cutting it. We got to get these people in the street. And that's when you do it, when you got a handle on them. The guy's in trouble right then, and I think he deserves his choice of one hell of a big fine or whatever, or treatment. We can do it, and we need these things. You know, another man that I had this past summer, about 7.5 years, he was so lucky to kill the people. And it was his second. There were two people died as a result of it. And so these are the kind of things that we got to have something to head off. And we have a handle on these people and they're turned right back out on the street. And I know that if I drink them, I don't know what all this, so I know I can't drink no more. But somebody had to get a hold on me to tell me that I couldn't drink, tell me why I couldn't drink, what was wrong with me, that I wasn't drinking. These are the kind of things that I'm looking at today, and this is a continual thing. We got these two particular people should have been, one of them should have been treated back in 1971 when we got his first DWI. You can set up all the classes you want to, you can come to a pastor off once a week, once a month. It'll help some. But what about after he gets picked up? What happens when we're falling short somewhere? We need something more than what we got. Somebody's not doing their job the first time or they wouldn't have success. And we do need a way to hold these people, whether we do it with the court. However, I don't know, but I know something's got to be done. And I do feel if we do something to this nation, that it's going to save the taxpayers' money, it's going to save people's lives, and it's going to give us something to work with. You know, there's a lot of us working. And I for one work on an average of about 16 hours a day. And
that's not a type of way, because it's not one of the best help I've ever had, because there is no money to pay their wages there. These are the kind of things. We've got 30 people in the studio club today, and two more on the way today. So there'll be 32 of us very soon. And but we're trying to do something with these people. I would much rather get somebody that is even come from jail if I got some kind of a hope on it. You know, they say it don't work, but it works.
But thank you. Anyway.
I agree with what he's saying, but he's.
We are unconsciously with your age.